It's time for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Financial planner Kevin McKinley has tips today on making money during retirement, disaster-proofing our financial and personal information, and more on the Equifax security breach. And of course, we welcome your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Well, as you know, and as most listeners know, I am retiring soon from Wisconsin Public Radio. And over the past few weeks, Kevin has been addressing a few topics that might be of interest to me, and I hope others who are either retired or retiring. What's on tap today, Kevin?
This week, Joy, we are going to tell you how to keep working after you stop working.
Well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, I know. Some people just aren't really good at retiring. They're like, yeah, I quit, and then I did that for 2 weeks, and then I thought, okay, I'm starting to get bored. Or even for people who aren't really in a retirement phase of their lives, but they might want to make a little extra money without having a traditional 9-to-5 full-time job. Unemployment right now, according to the traditional measurements anyway, is very low, about 4.4% nationwide. And employers like retirees as workers, especially those over 65, because generally they don't need health insurance. They have Medicare coverage. They don't need the money. They like having the money, but it's not something where they're trying to feed a family. And the employee can, it's good for the employee because they can take or leave the work as they need it. They can say, hey, I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. If you don't like it, I won't come back at all. But if it's okay with you, give me a call after my vacation is over with from my retirement. And generally, many retirees have the skills and the flexibility and the time that that employers appreciate, and it can be a very good match. And there's a website and a service for a small fee. You can look for these kinds of jobs that are very flexible in nature and can be about telecommuting, part-time, freelance, and it's called flexjobs.com, flexjobs.com, F-L-E-X-J-O-B-S.com. As I mentioned, it is a pay service. It's $14.95 a month, but it's $49.95 for a year for you to get access to jobs that have been well screened, so you're hopefully not getting a lot of come-ons or scams as well. And we'll have that link to the flexjobs.com website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, I've decided I'm not going to jump into another part-time job or new career right away, but maybe I want to make some spare cash. How can retirees start making some spare cash?
Would you be interested in the gig economy?
Depends on what kind of gig you want me to do here.
Not the first woman to have that skepticism to me in the past. According to a study by the company called Earnest, Uber and Lyft drivers make on average about $375 per month serving as kind of ersatz taxis who drive people around at their request. And Airbnb owners average $924 per month from their properties.
Wow.
You can also become a pet care person by going to petsitter.com, petsitter.com, and registering there and volunteering to take care of people's pets while they're away. You can take care of their slightly more precious people in their family by babysitting. Go to care.com or Craigslist and post it. And TaskRabbit is an interesting site because that's a site you can use to find or to post your particular skills and at a fee at which you're willing to do those skills. And it can be something as simple as, handy person activities like redoing a basement or fixing a leaky faucet. Or you can just say, look, I'll, for $20 an hour, I'll do all of your tasks today that you don't have time to do. Like, go get your cleaning, get some groceries, stop at the pharmacy, whatever. And TaskRabbit.com. Make sure before you undertake any of these gigs, though, that you check rules and insurance, especially as it relates to your vehicle and your home. And if you are going to be trying to make some money via Airbnb or VRBO, some of those other vacation rental services, that you check your zoning rules to make sure that you comply with the laws and consider the costs and benefits. If you make $400 a month say, driving people around, working for Uber or Lyft, you have to remember that driving most vehicles cost about 60 to 65 cents per mile in wear and tear, gas, depreciation, insurance, et cetera. So you might not come out exactly $400 ahead after you make that amount of money.
Nobody wants to drive around with me in my car, and nobody wants to stay in my house, so I won't be doing...
Actually, you know what I think is going to happen? I think many of us are going to miss you so much. We'll just pay to sit in your car and listen to you talk about today's issues while you just drive around and go get a cup of coffee
or
something.
Yeah, you don't need the radio on then.
Coffee with Joy.
That's funny. But you know, I thought about the pet sitting. That does actually, that's up right up my alley with my cat Ray and other pets. But I like to travel, and I need to get, I have to hire that pet sitter when I travel. Is there any way I can pick up a few bucks while traveling?
Absolutely. You can consider becoming a tour guide. Several thousand listings at the various job sites like CareerBuilder or Monster.com. And you can also pick your place of destination and get paid to stay there by becoming a house sitter. Huh. Go to HouseSitter.com and you pick a location that's got someone who has an empty house. They want to keep an eye on it, or they might have pets there that they need to be cared for while they're away. And you can actually either stay there for free or maybe even get paid for it depending on the desirability of the destination. You can become a travel companion and help someone else go where he or she wants to go and get paid to do it, as long as you just help them, or even just it can be as simple as escorting them through unfamiliar areas. And finally, if you really want to make some good money and see America, you can become a work camper.
A work camper? What's that?
WORKAMPER. These are RV owners who go where the work is. They're generally retirees. They have a decent RV, and then they drive around. Many times it's work on behalf of Amazon in different areas, might be in their distribution centers during peak seasons. But you're a work camper, and you take your camper and go work where you need it, park the camper in a lot and do some work. And then when the work there is done, you go on to the next destination if you wish. Wired Magazine recently had a profile of work campers up, and you can find out more information at workcamper.com, WORKAMPER.com. And again, we'll have a link to all of these websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
I just want to pass along Marilyn on Facebook, who writes, I retired from the UW in January, and I have no desire to work. My cat is thrilled and follows me around the house whenever I am home.
Very sensitive animals. They can perceive this new change in lifestyle. And I love having you here. Now go get me some food.
Yeah, and I think I'm gonna join Marilyn and just hang out with Ray for a while. And yeah, I'll get out and about, but we'll look into that extra income down the road. And I like those travel income ideas. That's something to consider. And speaking of retirement, I know that we have a very special membership drive coming up and pledge drive premium related to retirement.
That's right. Again, in honor of your career and your retirement, tune in this Saturday, September 23rd, and Tuesday, September 26th. Pledge any dollar amount during the On Your Money episodes and get your copy of Get Ready to Retire. This is one of our most popular On Your Money mini money booklets we have ever offered. And we haven't offered it in almost 4 years, and it might be at least that long until you get it again. We talk not only about people who are on the cusp of retirement, but also those of who are listen to us and are 25 years old and say, what should I be doing today so that I don't have to worry about my retirement when I'm 45 or 55 or 65? We tell you how to save for retirement, how to check your progress. We answer one of the most common questions posed to us regarding long-term care and Social Security, whether parents should save for their own retirement or for their kids' college. And we even give you that magic formula as to figure out how much you can spend each month in retirement.
You know, Kevin, I was at a listener event last week, and more than one listener asked me if I was able to retire because I do On Your Money with Kevin McKinney.
And you said, no, I need to retire because otherwise I have to do On Your Money with Kevin McKinney.
That's about what I said, too. No, I didn't. But it is true that while you are not my personal financial advisor, I am absolutely getting all sorts of information as we have talked over the years. And I think I remember that first time we offered the retirement a pledge drive premium, and that was very helpful. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. I'm sorry that it allowed you to leave us, but I'm very happy for you.
we are talking with Kevin McKinley. He is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We have a caller. Nancy in Fitchburg is with us. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, and congratulations on your long, successful career.
Thank you.
And that's for Joy, not Kevin.
Very good.
So my husband and I have done very well, being rather lazy investors, lots of index funds, well, aggressive savers, index funds at Vanguard, and right now, because we're both in, you know, our mid-60s, just retired, we're about 50-50 with cash equivalents. The problem, and it's a good one, but we inherited stocks from my uncle, and this was through Vanguard as well, and I kind of assumed it would be mutual funds, but as it has turned out, it's in stocks, and of course, this would be a good time to sell because there's, you know, small, it would be a very small tax implication. The problem is we don't have a financial advisor because we've been very satisfied with the strategy that we've used. One of the stocks is, and I'm not asking for specific information, but it's an ag commission, ag commodities business that pays a dividend of $1,800 a year. That would be on the amount that my uncle has passed on to me. We don't need the income. Motley Fool has said if you're going to buy an ag commodity business, there are better ones. We don't really know how to do our research to make up our mind about keeping or selling. And if we talk to Vanguard, I understand that, you know, they are still salespeople. They would want us to keep it in that and not cash it out. So where do we start?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
I knew you were going
to say that.
Sure.
I didn't catch that one. Yeah, start with Joy's kind words for her retirement. So what you're asking, Nancy, is you want to know where the cost basis is, where you can find the cost basis for these securities, correct?
Well, perhaps. And then how do we even decide if this would be? We do have some stock my husband's grandmother, like Yum and Pepsi, that's been really good, that was purchased 35 years ago. But we aren't stockholders. I mean, we
sure
don't want to worry about, you know, having.
Right.
But maybe it's really good, and we should make an exception for this for at least a portion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a decent amount of money.
So I agree with you. And thank you, Nancy, for not getting into specifics about your question. I appreciate that. First of all, for the inherited stocks, the cost basis is what the value of the security was on the date of death. And I'm sorry, you said it was from your uncle, correct?
Yes.
So you go into several different websites. We'll give you historical cost basis for a particular stock. The company might be able to provide it as well if you can call them and say, he died on this day. That is the new cost basis. But you're really, like you said, you're in good shape. Or you've done well for yourself, but you are at a point in your life where you're starting to wonder, not just personally probably, but more so investment-wise, what to do next and what to do with all these issues. And that's where good financial advisors, quite frankly, come in. And several people make it through these questions without ever consulting a financial advisor. They use their own judgment, trust it, and don't pay anybody, and they turn out just fine. Sometimes they turn out better than if they were to be with the wrong financial advisor. But it's very difficult. It's kind of like giving medical advice over the air. It's very difficult to think of a specific situation and say, okay, you should be 2% more in this stock and 3% less in that one, etc. One thing to keep in mind is that your attitude or your philosophy of kind of lazy investors has served you very well, because you probably haven't panicked during the stock market crashes of 87 and 2002 and 2008. And part of the reason you didn't panic is because you were working and you didn't rely on those investments for income. That changes dramatically when you retire and you start looking at those investments as the source of your sustenance over the next 20 or 30 or more years. And they're going down in value because, as despite our first segment, it's very difficult to go back to work usually and make the kind of money that you made while you were working. And so it might be a very good time if you, especially if you feel like you've reached a point of being financially independent where your investments will provide enough income, or you can spend the principal down and it'll be more than enough money for you to become more conservative. And we actually, as Joy alluded to earlier, we actually have a formula you can use if you tune in this Saturday or next Tuesday to the On Your Money segments in our Get Ready to Retire On Your Money Mini Money booklet. We have the whole formula you can use to figure out if you are indeed financially independent.
Good luck to you, Nancy. We need to take a short break. And when we come back, more questions, your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And here's an email from a college student who says, "Hi, Kevin. Love the show. I'm a 19-year-old college student making just enough money to pay for rent and tuition right now. However, I believe I have recently contracted Lyme disease and have experienced many of its common side effects. I do not have health insurance right now and do not want to go to urgent care without it because I don't want to incur debt due to medical bills. What are my options?"
Well, first of all, college student, I'm very glad you asked this question because it illustrates the issues that we have with healthcare in this country of people not getting treated because they're concerned about the financial cost of it, which of course then usually just exacerbates the problem and makes it even more expensive to treat once it gets worse. But good for you for at least looking into this at this point. Start by checking with your parents to see if you can get on their insurance. Checked my watch, and it seems that the ACA is still in effect.
Yes.
And so under those rules, people age 26 and under can still get on their parents' insurance, or you may be able to get your own low-cost, lower cost anyway, health insurance as a student. Go to healthcare.gov, put the information in there, and it's not just about students, it's about any adult who needs health insurance. Go to healthcare.gov, see what your options are, and you might be surprised at what you can come up with and the price you can get for it.
Yeah, well, let's say that maybe that price is too high or the parents don't have insurance or something. What if those aren't feasible options?
He should check with his school, and they usually have a student health services department. Google your school's name and student health services, and they'll have someone there who can either treat you or refer you out for the primary care that you need to some kind of local provider. And again, usually they can do it. They understand that you're a student, and that's one of the reasons why they have the facility there. And they understand that you usually don't have a ton of money or you might not have insurance, and so they'll either be able to treat you or they'll be able to send you someplace you can get help.
Yeah. What about people who aren't students or can't get on their parents' health insurance?
You know, you should at least call the local clinic, the local hospital, and urgent care and explain your situation, because I can guarantee that is a call that they get about once every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It says, "I think I need to be treated for something. I don't have health insurance. How am I going to pay for this?" And explain the situation. Ask what options are available. You might want to look up free clinics by going to dhs.wisconsin.gov that has a map-based locations of free clinics in the area or low-cost treatment clinics in the state of Wisconsin. And this is a good advice for everybody. Save this number in your contact information, but call 211. If you dial 211, just like dialing 911, except it's not for something that it's an emergency. It's you say, "I'm struggling with health issues or mental health issues, chemical dependency, whatever. Here's where I live. What resources and options are available to me that I don't know about and I don't know where to trust. Call 211. But most importantly, college student, please get treated for the symptom, because the earlier you catch it, obviously, the better off it'll be and the less expensive it will be.
Yeah. You don't want to fool around with Lyme disease. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. And our next caller is Jacqueline Inslinger. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi. My question kind of relates back to your conversation about working after retirement. I was given advice, and it was free advice, so that's about how much it's worth, to sign up for Social Security when I turn 62, which is just around the corner for me, and then continue working full-time. That way, the Social Security will continue to accumulate. But let's say I have a heart attack or some kind of major injury at work, because I'm a truck driver, that's always a possibility, that I would be immediately start receiving Social Security if I'm unable to work.
That I don't know to be true. It could be, but I don't think that's the case. What typically happens is if you get injured, you apply for Social Security disability. And the good and the bad news about that is it's there for you. The bad news is it takes a long time to get approval for it. You have to be legitimately disabled, and it can take months, if not years, to get approval for that payments to come. And if you do get injured, then of course you can apply for regular retirement Social Security at that particular time. But if you apply for Social Security now, while you're under full retirement age, which is around 66 for most people, what happens is that any earnings you have as a truck driver or whatever that are above and beyond a certain amount, which is just about $17,000, you actually lose Social Security benefits. A dollar for every $2 of earnings over that roughly $17,000 amount. So if you're getting $17,000, let's say, of Social Security in the form of retirement income, and you're earning, if you make $34,000, it will wipe out half of the Social Security that you're receiving. That'll be pulled back away from you. Now, the good news is, even if you do that, you will still get a higher benefit after you reach full retirement age to reflect the money that you lost while you were under full retirement age. But I wouldn't necessarily do that just for the circumstances that you've described. It usually, you qualify for Social Security disability, or you can get retirement for it if you need the money right away and your disability case isn't approved when you actually need the money.
Yeah. Thank you, Jacqueline. Let's go to Dennis in Shatek next. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin. My question was probably similar to what you just answered. It has to do with my wife visited her financial planner yesterday. She was told that she would need to, and upon full retirement, would need to give up one of three small part-time jobs that she had. Otherwise, it would affect her Social Security. And I didn't think that was true after full retirement. Is there a limit?
Not after full retirement age. How old is she?
She's 66 now.
No, she can collect her full benefit, and it won't be affected by her earnings at all. What they might have been referring to is the fact that the Social Security is technically a tax-free source of income in retirement, but there's a standards at which calculation, if you will, that they add in half your Social Security plus all of your income from other sources. And once that exceeds a certain threshold, then your Social Security can become taxable as income, up to 50% of it at a certain threshold, and then 85% of the income can become taxable in the worst case scenario. Now, that still just means you still get to keep it. It's just a portion of it is going to go for income taxes, and that may be what they're referring to. But you still end up with, a much higher portion of money by working and having the Social Security tax than not working at all.
Thank you, Dennis, and good luck to you and your wife. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, during this edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 is our number, and we do have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. You can also email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And And it is time now for Smart Assets. With the recent disasters in the news lately, we've been talking about how to prepare yourself for a large or small-scale emergency. And today we will learn how to disaster-proof our financial and personal information. How do we do that, Kevin?
Well, these disasters in question, Joy, could, of course, be floods or storms. They could be natural or human-made disasters. It might affect a large geographic area, or it could be just you. It could be simple as water damage in your basement where all your records were kept, or a fire or something. And putting all this information in one safe place may be of use to you if you're traveling and you need it. You could be overseas and you might need some information for medical purposes or other legal purposes. Or if you become incapacitated and someone else has to take over your affairs. Or if you become really incapacitated and you're dead and you need, for the purposes of settling an estate, to have all this information in one safe place that is hopefully accessible by only the people who need to see it.
So what do I need in this safe place?
Have you got a pen and paper handy, Joy?
I do.
Okay, here's a list of what you need. Start with your personal information, birth certificate, marriage certificate, divorce decree, if you will, death certificate for any other family members who've passed away, your Social Security number, your driver's license, and your passport. For property, you probably want to have deeds to any real estate, titles to any vehicles that you own. For financial reasons, you want to have tax returns, at least the first couple pages of your 1040s for the last 2 or 3 years, any financial statements, like at least the front page of an investment statement, the account numbers, and then, of course, the passwords to those all of those online accounts, credit and debit cards, maybe a picture of those so you can get at the number, and then contact information for each one of those companies. So if you or someone else needs to get a hold of them, they know where to call. Finally, for health insurance, you need the health insurance, a copy of the policy coverage card, if you will, the immunizations that you or any children have had, and then your prescription, so that if you need an emergency prescription for something that you're having a hard time getting without a doctor's signing off on it, you have that in front of you as well. And there's FEMA came out with a huge guide to how to list all these things, where to put them, and even more exhaustive than what we've talked about here. It's about a 35-page PDF file. We'll put a link up to it at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Well, boy, I know what my first project is going to be.
That sounds fun. What a great way to spend the first few days of retirement.
Jeez, I can't believe I haven't done this. It really is a good idea, and I haven't done this. So once we gather all this stuff, where do we put it?
It depends on your level of paranoia. For some people, a box is fine, and even an unorganized box, just a box in the closet where all the paper goes, and it's somebody else's job to sort through it. You might also want to lock a file cabinet that will prevent a little bit from theft or prying eyes or from certain types of fire or flood damage. You may want to look at a safe if you've got the room for it in there, or you might want to have a safety deposit box down at a local financial institution like a bank. And those belt and suspenders types may want to have all three. They may want to have a box, they may want to have a safe and a safety deposit box, depending on who needs to get it what, when, and where.
Yeah, my problem is I've got all this stuff in different boxes, but it's not all together. So
no, it's diversified, they call that.
Right. So it might not be possible to get access to those documents when we need them, where we need them. So what do you do then?
You might want to think about storing copies in the cloud. It can be as simple as just taking a picture of some of these things with your smartphone, and then you've at least got a picture on hand so you can get at that. But you also want to back up the phone, so if the data is lost and that's your only source of it, you can still get at the data as well. A little more sophisticated way is to scan the documents in and then store them in the cloud via Dropbox, Google Drive. Many free services will store more than enough data of what you need in these documents, or if you want to pay for it, it might be, you know, $5 or $10 a year or something. PC Bag recently reviewed all the scanning and storage services, and they said if you're going to use one, you probably want to look at CertainSafe or Google Drive. We'll have links to those websites at onyourmoney.com. And you want to keep access to that information in the cloud as secure as possible. So maybe don't share, you know, the password or the login information with the person who you've designated as the executor of your estate, some other trusted person, your attorney, your CPA, somebody else who can come forward and say, well, I know how to get into this information. But in many of these services, you can actually tell if they have actually logged into it. So you can monitor it to see if they're going into it and looking at it before it's an absolute necessity.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner from Eau Claire. He is managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Our number, if you have a question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jeff in Door County is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I have a question about some investment strategy. My partner and I, non-married, have multiple accounts. Some are tax-deferred from 403Bs primarily and 457s. And one of the things that I've not read anything about is strategizing to maximize growth by converting some of those into...
His call dropped. Converting them into Roth IRAs is what I got off of that. But is that enough information, Kevin?
I think I'm just going to make up what the rest of the question was. The question is probably which assets should I keep or convert into IRAs versus Roth IRAs? And it's a tricky question because of the nature of investments, in that you want the maximum amount of growth possible in these retirement accounts, because you want the maximum growth, but also you want to be able to shelter any earnings from taxation so that you can hopefully keep the money growing. But growth, despite the last few months or years of the stock market, is generally not linear, meaning it doesn't always just go straight up without any declines. And so some people may want to have some investments in those retirement accounts so they can shelter any gains, but some outside of it, because if they go down in value, you want to at least be able to realize the losses and have those losses offset other capital gains or other income that you've incurred. And so the way that we currently have a tax code, and again, this is something that may change in a week when the Republicans' new tax rules come out, or the proposed new tax rules. But as of now, some investments are actually better held outside of those retirement accounts, and because of the way that the dividends are taxed, and then you might want to have safer things that pay interest because of the way that that tax is sheltered. Otherwise, there's really no way to know for sure which investments are best off held in IRAs or Roth IRAs. It's more about saying, what will I be more likely to have to get access to? I might want to keep money in a Roth IRA if I'm over 59 and a half. That's safer because I'm more likely to want to pull that out, because if I need it in an emergency, I don't want to pull it out of an IRA and pay a huge tax bill on top of this extra money that I need. And so, therefore, you can't look at it just from a tax standpoint. You also have to look at it for your personal situation.
And Jeff in Door County, that we lost your call. Time for another break. When we come back, we are going to have some more information on the Equifax security breach, and we'll welcome more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. And money is always on our minds each week at this time. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. Information and advice on your money. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Last week, we discussed the Equifax hack, and the situation is rapidly evolving, so we wanted to give you an update on what you need to know and what you need to do. What is the latest, Kevin?
Well, things haven't really improved. Equifax, again, revealed on, I believe it was September 6th, that someone had gotten into their systems and obtained information on 143 million Americans. This could be their names, their addresses, their social security numbers, their birth dates, their driver's license, and for about 209,000 people, their credit or debit card numbers. The company has been trying to respond and keep up with things. They haven't always been as forthcoming as we would like for something that's so egregious, but they have put measures in place. That said, the systems are overloaded, and even people who have called in and report it back to me and to get the response that they're hearing. Sometimes these poor call center people, who, by the way, this was not their fault, so don't take it out on them, have said, ma'am, 143 million people are affected. You're going to have to wait a bit before we can get to you. That's why we're trying to handle things as quickly as we can, but it's going to take some time.
Are you still recommending that people start at the Equifax site?
Yes, sadly, even though they haven't been very reliable so far in providing the information and in terms that that I think they should, you can go to EquifaxSecurity2017.com. You can check to see if your information was exposed. You can get more information on measures you can take to protect yourself, and you can sign up for 1 year of free credit monitoring from the company if you wish. Now, again, keep in mind, not only is it going to be difficult to get a person on the telephone there, but it's sometimes the websites have become so overloaded that people can't even log in from there. So you're going to expect to wait a long time if you are calling in. Expect the website to probably not work as quickly as you would like, and you may even get different answers from different people depending on the situation. So write everything down or print it out as you get it so you can save it for future use.
What about freezing credit reports?
I still think that's the best idea. What that does is that goes to the three major credit bureaus, and there's a couple other ones, Innovis and Check System, which are minor credit bureaus. What a credit bureau does is it stores this information. And when any entity wants information on you, usually it's a legitimate institution, might be a bank or credit card company or something, they want to market to certain people. So they pay Equifax or any of these other bureaus to get information on a specific kind of customer that they're trying to target. And the problem is, of course, is that we didn't hand our information over to these credit bureaus. The credit bureaus accumulated it and assembled it and sell it on their own. And when they goof up, of course, we have to pay the price for it, not just in fear, but also if there is an actual event. Freezing your credit report means that it makes it more difficult for someone who does not have a business relationship with you already, meaning a credit card company, let's say, that you don't already have, or a mortgage company where you don't have a mortgage with them. It makes it difficult for them to go into your bureau and get bureau report and get your information. By freezing it, it usually costs about $10 to freeze, and it says, unless I give you a password or a PIN number, you may not open this report back up to anybody. And if you need actually to use your credit information, say to get a car loan in the future, usually what happens is you go to the lender, you say, which bureau are you going to use and when are you going to check my credit information? And they'll tell you, and then you contact that bureau and open up the file for maybe 48 hours so that the lender can actually look at the information for it. But it's still the best way to protect against identity theft, and I do recommend you do it not only for the big three bureaus, but also at the for the smaller ones like Innovis and Check Systems. And we'll have some links. We've put a piece up last week on this, but it's still relevant, of some places you can go for help at onyourmoney.com. It's the featured article on the front page of the website.
Is it worth it to pay to freeze your credit and go through the hassle with all other bureaus if your information was not exposed in this Equifax hack?
I really think it is. Just to take one step back from this particular event and just assume that your information is out there. It's a very small price to pay. Some of these bureaus are now reevaluating under some threats to say maybe we shouldn't be charging these people to lock up information that technically is their own information. It just gums up the system, so the bureaus and the other institutions can't make money as quickly for it. But if those of us who have that information out there are willing to take the extra step to freeze the credit reports, I definitely think it's a good idea to do it. And I do think if this is really bothering you, you should look at some of those paid for services like LifeLock or Identity Force, where you may pay $10 or $20 a month for a while. And it's kind of like, it's not a prevention against the loss. It's where they monitor the system with more diligence maybe than what you could do on your own, and they'll alert you if there is some kind of problem for it. It's like all other kinds of insurance where, you know, people might say, well, this is a waste of money, but you don't, look at your homeowner's insurance premiums, let's say, as a waste of money if your house doesn't burn down in a given year. You have that insurance there for protection if something happens. But also check with your credit union or your bank. Certain other places offer a free credit monitoring that maybe isn't quite as diligent as the paid-for ones, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah. So is there anything else we should consider?
Right. We're going to be talking about this, sadly, Joy, well past your retirement. Yeah. We might have our own special segment on this each week. You definitely need to monitor all of your accounts for any charges that look suspicious. These are your debit card accounts, your credit card accounts. You need to look at bills that you get from healthcare providers, because there's a danger that people are going to use your information to apply for health insurance or health care or Medicare. We're going to talk about this in the next few months or so, but there's a bigger danger now than ever that the IRS is going to get a bunch of fraudulently prepared returns after the first of the year that claim to get a big refund, that used your Social Security number to file, and then when you actually do go to file in February or March, the IRS says, no, you already have your return and we gave you your big fat refund. Why are you submitting your taxes again? It was actually somebody else. Don't respond to any emails or any phone calls from any entity claiming to be anything, credit card company, credit bureau, Equifax, anything. Usually what they will do is send you something via regular mail if they need to get in touch with you. And if you are looking at an email and it looks legitimate, rather than clicking on anything in the body or the heading, log out of email and go to that company's actual website and see if they really are trying to reach you for it. We're going to talk about a couple steps that you can take. Again, more belt and suspenders plans, including two-factor authentication, in a couple of weeks.
And we have a question about a credit bureau. Nancy in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Nancy.
Well, you actually answered my question just in the last few paragraphs that that Kevin spoke, but the reason that I was so enthusiastic about using all of these credit agencies is that I have an 800 credit score, and it immediately occurred to me after this fracas occurred was that certainly they would try to use the credit of people who already have. Am I correct in thinking?
You know what, Nancy? That's actually a great point. Is, you know, why was it Willie Sutton who said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with this. Why would you try to steal the credit of someone with a 620 credit score or when you could go after someone with an 800 credit score?
Thank you for agreeing with my thinking.
Yeah, so no, I think you should all do it regardless of your credit score, but you're right, you may be even more vulnerable for it. Now, what usually happens in the past anyway, someone who may steal your information opens up a credit card account, they get the statement delivered someplace else so you don't see it until it's too late. I've never heard of a person who's been liable for a credit card charged up that's not in their name. Usually once they prove, and it's relatively easy to prove, like, this wasn't me, the bank says, okay, that's fine. This is why we have insurance or whatever to cover this so you don't have it. The problem really comes in is if that debt in the meantime has been sold to a credit collection agency or sold again and sold again, sold again, and it's out there and it's bought for pennies on the dollar, you might get a call in 5 years saying, hey, Nancy, we see that you charged a credit card up here. You didn't pay it back. We have the right to that debt. You say, no, it was identity theft, wasn't me. And they say, well, prove it. In the meantime, we're going to take you to small claims court.
Nancy, thanks very much for the call. And I know Nancy was wondering about this Innovis credit bureau. I had not heard of that before. So there's four credit bureaus. Kevin, are you there, Kevin?
I'm sorry, say that again, Joy.
Are there four credit bureaus then with this?
There are actually a bunch of them. I think there's over a half dozen. The major ones are Equifax, TransUnion, and the Santa Maria, I think. No, wait, that's not what it is. But it's Check Systems. Yeah, Experian and Check Systems are some of the other ones that are out there. And the best one is just to go to the big three. And again, go to onyourmoney.com to see the links to all the different websites for the major bureaus.
Sue emails, love this show. Joy, I'm so sorry you're retiring, but happy for you. You and Kevin work well together. Thank you very much, Sue. It's a pleasure listening to you. It's a pleasure doing this show sometimes. she continues, I've been listening to the Equifax situation and decided to put a credit freeze on my reports. There was an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in which they did not recommend doing it online, and they provided phone numbers for the four reports, including Innovis. I called the Equifax number, and it's an automated system. When it got the address, it would not accept ours, so they recommended you send the information in the mail. With all this happening, I'm reluctant to put that information on a piece of paper in the mail. What do you recommend?
Actually, it's probably safer in the mail than it is online. You know, for you know, centuries. We've had mail that's been sitting unlocked in most post boxes, and we really have very few stories of information being stolen via a post office box where someone drives by, opens up a P.O. box, pulls it out, and sees what they get. Whereas online, it's so quick and so scalable where they can get into it and see it and download it and skim and scan for the pertinent information that the crooks are trying to find. It's actually much more work to do that. So I'm perfectly fine with doing it via regular mail, and I'm not surprised, again, because in this very short window of time that has elapsed since the event was exposed, they're just so overwhelmed that it's going to be very difficult to call in, even on an automated system. You know, all these things are, there's not unlimited capacity on a website or a phone system. And if 10 million people were calling in all at the same time, that's going to crash the system and mean that the rest can't get in. So, yeah, if they said to send it through the mail, yes, I'm perfectly fine with that, and I'd recommend you do that.
Thank you, Sue. Joe in Madison is with us now. Hi, Joe.
See, I have an individual retirement, a rollover account. I'm concerned about a correction in the market because I've lost money with this before a couple, three times. It's just gotten built up. I want to buy CDs at the bank where this account is actually held, keep the CDs, and I can actually go from the CDs back to the rollover account if things look, you know, great in the future. I'm concerned about losing it in a correction in the market, and I just wanted your opinion on that.
Sure. If you're self-aware enough, Joe, where you realize that you really are concerned about it, a lot of people don't become aware of how painful a correction can be until the correction actually happens, and by then it's often too late to do anything about it. And I agree with that. And I like CDs because they're FDIC insured. Depending on the dollar amount at the institution, they're very predictable. They don't pay much. You might make 1% or 2% a year. But you know exactly what's going to happen to your money and when you're going to get it back. And most importantly of all, for your situation, you can usually pull the money out of those CDs with little or no penalty for early withdrawal. So if, let's say, you pull it out today, put it in a CD, and 2 years from now, you are either more comfortable with longer-term, more aggressive investing, or prices offer a better risk-reward proposition, you can get at the money that's been in the CDs and put it back in that point. And even for your case, you may, Joe, for a longer-term solution, you might want to say, you know what, I'm going to split this up, and I'm going to put half of it leave half of it in the more aggressive ones and keep the other half in CDs. Then, if and when things do decline for the more aggressive part, I'll not only avoid some of the decline with some of my money, but I'll also have money I can use to spend, or I can reinvest in the future if I want.
Good luck, Joe. Time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we've been talking a lot about identity theft, and we're going to be in the future. But in the meantime, usa.gov/identity-theft is a great clearinghouse of all kinds of information you need to protect yourself, find the credit bureaus, get the latest updates on the different laws and the changes. usa.gov/identity-theft. And again, we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And, Kevin, we are going to have a special live pledge drive edition of On Your Money coming up this Saturday, and that special popular retirement premium.
Yes, the On Your Money Mini Money Booklet, one of our most popular ones ever, updated for today's dates, numbers, figure situation. Get ready to retire, whether you're 19 or 90. This is information that you need to have a comfortable retirement and stress-free, like we're going to give to Joy. And one thing I would ask of you is to, especially to pledge something during Saturday's or next Tuesday's show as a commemoration of Joy Cardine's career at Wisconsin Public Radio. Show her what she's meant to you. So we'll have that ready for you noon on Saturday and at 8 a.m. on Tuesday, September 26th.
And we will talk to you then, Kevin. Do you have four more words before we go?
I do. Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.